This is As a Matter of Faith, a program presenting an array of religious scholars and leaders discussing significant and current matters of religious interest. As a Matter of Faith is produced in the studios of WUSM Public Radio at the University of Southern Mississippi with the support of the College of Arts and Letters, the School of Mass Communication and Journalism, and the Department of Philosophy and Religion. Your host for As a Matter of Faith, Dr. Alan Eichelman.
Hello, my name is Dr. Alan Eichelman. I am in the Department of Philosophy and Religion here at the University of Southern Mississippi, and I am welcoming you to As a Matter of Faith, an interfaith dialogue show in which we interview guests on a wide range of religious topics. And today I have with me in the studio Lou Ginsberg, and Mrs. Ginsberg is a member of the congregation B'nai Israel, located right here in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And she has been in Hattiesburg, Mississippi since 1952. She moved here with her husband at that time, whom she met in college. And her husband is a longtime attorney who unfortunately passed away a few years ago, but is known to many throughout the Hattiesburg community. And what we're going to be talking with Lou about today is Judaism, and specifically Southern Judaism, but Judaism in general, and some of her experiences as a Jew in the South. And so with that, I just got, like to say, Lou, welcome to the show. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
One of the things that we were talking about that I found very interesting was the way that your family came to the South, came to Louisiana first, where you grew up. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, my father came to this country, I think he was about 16 years old. He came all by himself because he had an uncle in Monroe, Louisiana. And my uncle had a store, so he went to work for my uncle.
And this was back in about 1938, is that correct?
Oh, no. This was way
earlier than that.
Earlier in the 19th century that he came, because I don't know the exact year. He brought his family here in 1938, uncles and brothers and nephews he brought here in 1938, but he came earlier, much earlier.
And bringing the family in 38 was, to an extent, motivated by what was happening in Germany at that time.
That's right. They were escaping at the time.
From the Nazis in Germany.
Correct.
And you were talking about how much it cost to bring someone in.
They said, if I remember correctly, it cost $200 a person to bring them in, and I guess they paid that to the German council. I don't know.
So that, in today's dollar, that'd be several thousand dollars a person.
There were 12 of them.
So that would be a lot of money in today's
dollar.
That's
right, but the community in Bastrop and Monroe helped with that.
Now you're talking about the Jewish community.
The Jewish community helped him.
So these folks probably owed their lives, literally owed their lives, to this effort to bring them in to Louisiana at that time.
That's right, because some of those that did not come they perished in the Holocaust.
Yeah, because you lost family during the Holocaust.
Yes, my father had a brother and a sister. And he tried to get his sister to come, but she waited too late. That was it. His mother wouldn't come. She waited too late. So those that came were his brother and his wife and their children, different nephews and nieces. And then he had another nephew who came much earlier, who was here prior to 1938, and he lived with us.
You know, I think many people think of the Holocaust as something that happened in Europe, which indeed it did, but at the same time, so many Jews, if not most Jews in this country, were impacted seriously by the Holocaust. You couldn't lose, like at that time, one-third of the entire population of all the Jews in the world and not be significantly impacted as an American Jew. And what you're talking about testifies, I think, to that fact.
Well, when they came over here, I was only 8 years old when they came. But it changed things for me, too, because I remember I had a playhouse, and my dad had built me a table. And when his family came here, they didn't have anything at the time. And they took my table out of my playhouse, and I acted so ugly because they took my table, and my father made me feel guilty finally. But they came here with nothing. And everybody in the Jewish community helped them. And probably the Christian community, too. I just don't remember.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a hallmark of the Jewish community, is that kind of the philanthropy to one another, but also philanthropy to the wider community. And that's something else we talked about, is the way that Jews have done so much, even in the South with limited numbers, to help the wider community. And one of personal note on that, you were talking about your uncle and one of his employees and helping that African-American employee. Would you like to tell us a little bit about
that? Well, he worked in my uncle's store. This was in Tallulah, Louisiana, and he had a drug store and a dry goods store. And Pete was the janitor, but he knew that Pete had potential. I mean, this is the way I saw it. That he had potential, so he'd sent him to college in New Orleans to Dillard. And Pete eventually became superintendent of education in Tallulah, Louisiana.
How about that? That's an incredible story. That's a wonderful story.
But my uncle did that for a lot of people who needed him. Mm-hmm. He did it for his family also.
For both inside and outside the family.
Right, that kind
of,
right.
And there is a real spirit of Jewish philanthropy. And one of the things that I think I was sharing with you, and I don't know if you were aware of that or not, but the Stern family in New Orleans, who were the publishers of the Times-Picayune, and whose house, Longview, is now open for public tour, that family was really a driving force to give money to Dillard University again. To make Dillard what it is today, it's a Christian college. It started out as a small Christian college for the college for the African American community, but the stature that it has today is to a large extent due to that Stern money that was given.
I didn't realize it was the Stern family.
It was the Stern family.
I know about
really
Longview Gardens.
Yeah, they were prime supporter of Dillard University, and there's just a lot of different examples of Jewish philanthropy here in the South, where you've got a population, a group of people who are really relatively small percent of the total population in the South, but have made some incredible contributions. And I just find that gratifying to know that a small community can have that kind of impact. So one of the things we're on a lighter note, Lou, one of the things that we were talking about was the your accent. And Lou just absolutely surprised me and delighted me when I heard her accent, because here is this Jewish lady who has an incredible Southern accent. And she says, well, what do you expect? I'm from the South. Well, of course, what would I expect? But I do find your accent very appealing.
Well, whenever I travel and someone says to me, where are you from, honey child? I always tell them I'm from Australia.
I love it.
I don't think much about my Southern accent.
Well, I think a lot of people in the country would be surprised, because they would expect Jews to sound like Billy Crystal or like somebody from New York. And that's
None
not necessarily
do.
The case. Jews are going to sound like wherever they happen to be from in the country.
Right.
Another thing that I find significant is the Jewish response to the civil rights movement back in the 60s. And we were talking a little bit about that as well before the show. And why don't we focus a little bit on that? Because I think the Jews had a unique relationship to that whole movement on several different levels. And you mentioned that your rabbi at that time was very much involved in civil
rabbi
rights.
Rabbi Charles Banton Band was very involved in the civil rights movement. And he really scared us because we were afraid that we'd have a bomb go off in the temple or something like that. But it didn't bother him. He wasn't afraid. He was very active.
And did he make that evident, like in services at the temple?
Oh yes, they sort of asked him, I think, to tone down some of the things he was talking about, but he would not, and he told them he would not, and he would not give up what he was doing for the civil rights movement, but. We, and I say we because it bothered me too, that there would be retribution, that because they bombed the temple in Jackson and they bombed the temple in Meridian, and we were afraid that would happen to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the Ku Klux Klan at the time was coming against the Jewish community in many respects the same way they were coming against the African-American community.
They harassed us as well. In some way or other.
So that's why there was kind of an ambivalence, I think, on the part of many Jews, is what you're pointing to, because they felt at one with the African-American community in terms of that, but afraid of the kind of retribution if they spoke out too loudly in the other hand. So it put the Jews in a very tenuous and difficult position here in the South.
The Jewish merchants had a time dealing with it. The TV station had a time dealing with it. And we were just very cautious.
You told me that your rabbi asked you to do something, which you did, but you kind of didn't tell anyone.
I didn't tell anybody, especially I didn't tell my husband, because he was afraid for me, not because I was going to The rabbi asked me, since he didn't drive, to take he and his wife to a black college, I think it was in Prentice, to speak. And I didn't tell my husband because he didn't care that I would go to a black college, but he thought it might be dangerous. So I didn't tell anybody. We went to Prentice. I think it was in Prentice. And he spoke. And I came home and nobody knew until now.
Okay. Well, we'll pick up with there in just a bit, but for now we're going to be taking a little break, and when we come back from the break, I've got some more questions for Lou and some more ground that we'd like to cover here. So thank you so far, Lou. We'll be talking to you again in just a bit.
You are listening to As a Matter of Faith. Today's guest is Mrs. Lou Ginsberg. To share your comments and opinions about As a Matter of Faith, please email us at wusm@usm.edu. This is episode number 2 of As a Matter of Faith.
Hello and welcome back to As a Matter of Faith. This is Dr. Alan Eichelman, the Department of Philosophy and Religion here at the University of Southern Mississippi. And I have in the studio with me Lou Ginsberg, who is a member of Temple B'nai Israel here in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, a longstanding member since 1952, in fact, of B'nai Israel. And so it's good to have you with us, Lou, and we'll just continue our discussion from before. We were talking about, when we left off, the response of Jews to the civil rights movement. And one of the things that you were talking about is your husband's work in this arena as a practicing attorney in Hattiesburg, and about his relationship with his clients, many of whom were African-American. And why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
He wasn't really a civil rights attorney, but he had many black clients who he helped in one way or another when they got in trouble with the police here. He was just someone they felt comfortable calling. And I didn't tell you this before, but when they integrated the schools, the 10th grade especially, our child who was in the 10th grade went to the black school, and many of the students went to the private school, so they wouldn't have to go to the school with the blacks. But we believed in public education, so we went over to the school, and they elected my husband president of the PTA. He hadn't been to a PTA meeting in years, but they made him president of the PTA because he was the only one that the blacks and the whites both accepted. So that was the kind of person he was. He was a friend to the blacks. They could depend upon him. And I remember when a little 12-year-old boy was arrested, a little black boy, for shoplifting. And they took him and put him in jail, and they didn't let him call his mother.
In the general population. A 12-year-old boy they threw in the general population.
Yeah. So anyway, we had been at a party, and they finally got us, our babysitter finally got us, and we went down to the jail, and they had this little 12-year-old boy in jail with all these grown people. And I just remember my husband standing out on the street because they wouldn't let me go down to the jail, and they wouldn't let me stand on the street corner by myself. So Herbert was standing on the street corner yelling at the policeman for arresting a 12-year-old boy and putting him in jail with adults and not calling his parents. And he was yelling at them about police brutality and why we have such a bad reputation, and I thought they're going to knock him in the head and I don't know what's going to happen to me. But that was just the way he was. He felt very strongly about that.
I wish I could have met him. He sounds like a man who had a keen sense for justice.
Well, he did. He was very outspoken, and he wasn't always nice and polite or politically correct, but he looked out for his black clients. Many of them didn't have any money, and they would come do odd jobs for us, or they would give us chickens or vegetables or something like that. But they were always grateful to him.
A real country attorney who was willing to engage in the kind of barter system.
Well, he was a real country attorney. He did everything. He could do any kind of law, malpractice, anything.
Well, like I said, he sounds like a fascinating man. I wish I had the opportunity to know him. Shifting gears here a little bit, Lou, I know one of the things that has been very near and dear to your heart, something that you were involved in for like 30 years, was Jacob's Camp, located in Utica, Mississippi. Could you tell us a little bit about Jacob's Camp, what it is, how it came into being, why it's important, and also some of your personal experiences at Jacob's Camp?
Well, Jacob's Camp was started in 1970. It opened its doors in 1970 when Celeste Orkin, who wanted something for our Jewish youth to have, somehow went to URJ, which is the Union for Reform Judaism, and told them we needed a camp. And they said they could never support a Jewish camp in the Deep South. But Celeste and several other people persevered, and we opened the camp. I say we. I really was not involved in that. But she started the youth program for high school youth so they would have a place to go for conventions and things like that. And then the camp, which is for children from first to the 12th grade. They spend 4 to 8 weeks in the summer at the camp where they're with other Jewish children. And it's like any other camp. It's a sports camp. They have a dance program. They have a computer program, and they have Jewish studies. And it's just a place where Jewish children can go to strengthen their Jewish identity and to help sustain Judaism. And then when they're entering the 11th grade, they take the children, they're not really children now, they're teenagers, take them to Israel, to Poland and Israel. I think they still do that. I know they still go to Israel. I don't know that they still go to Poland. But that also strengthens their Jewish identity. So it's a very well thought out program that the URJ, Union of Reform Judaism, supports, and each synagogue supports it because their children participate.
Now, when they go to Poland, I take it that they go to the concentration sites in Poland.
Oh, they see everything.
The war camps.
They learn all the history of what's happened to the Jews.
And so they're talking about the Warsaw Ghetto and the struggle for the Warsaw Ghetto at that time.
Right.
And how the Jews put up the last line of basically resistance against a highly mechanized army, utilizing whatever they had at their disposal for that resistance.
And they take them to Masada. They learn about that. Don't ask me the history of that, but I know they take them to Masada. I have had some great experiences working at Jacob's Camp. Now that I don't work there anymore, I've seen children grow up who have children there of their own that are going to camp now. And when I see these young people that I haven't seen maybe in 10 or 15 or 20 years, and they say to me, "Oh, Lou, you look just the same as you did when you were at camp." And I think, oh, surely I didn't look this old when I was back at camp. But I have some wonderful experiences, and I hear from these young people all the time.
That must be very gratifying, Lou.
It is. It was some of the best years of my life, and my husband's too, because he came over every weekend. He was here in Hattiesburg, and then he would come to camp on Friday and leave on Sunday. And every Saturday night, he cooked hamburgers for all the campers and staff. And they called them Herbie Burgers. And they still call them Herbie Burgers, even though he's not there.
Okay. Is there a particular experience that sticks out in your mind that is
at
significant?
Camp?
At camp, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always said I was born 30 years too soon, because these young people seem to be having such a good time with each other. And I don't remember having that experience. I went to camp, but it wasn't like what these kids have. But I can't think of any one particular experience. They were all so great, and they all liked me. I think they did anyway. And they were good to me.
I'm sure they did if they keep in contact with you all these years.
Yeah, I do keep in contact with them.
Now, were there any future marriages arranged because of Jacob's Camp?
Oh, they talk about camp marriages. I can't tell you how many young people found each other at camp and have gotten married. I've been to, I think, just like 5 weddings this past year of former campers that met at camp or met through the youth program.
That's fantastic. That is fantastic.
It really is.
All these years being a Jew in the South, how have you found that experience to be both invigorating and challenging?
What? I didn't understand the
being
question.
Being a Jew here in the South, how have you found that to be both invigorating, you know, because of the special identity that you have as a Jew in the South, but also the unique challenges that you might have as a Jew in the South?
I haven't had any challenges. Mm-hmm. The only problem we had and it wasn't really a problem, the country club didn't ask the Jews to belong until the country club burned down and they wanted to build another one. And then they wanted our money. And that was a challenge to me because I said, I'm not going to join. They just want me now. But one of the big shots came to see us and said, you know, 90% of the people don't care whether you join or not. 5% would really like to see you join. We have a swimming pool. There wasn't another swimming pool in town except at the motels because they closed the pools so the blacks and the whites wouldn't have to swim together. So it's a place for your children to go. And the 5% that don't want you don't have to be around you. So we joined for the children so they would have a place to go swim.
We do a lot of things for the sake of our children, don't
we?
Yeah.
But as far as a challenge, I've had a good life in Hattiesburg. Being Jewish has not been a challenge. I haven't had any problems because I'm Jewish. And life goes on.
Well, life has been exciting, interesting, and certainly has taken many different twists and turns for you, Lou. And we do appreciate your sharing your experiences as a Southern Jew. And thank you very much for being on our show. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up for the day and just say until next time, as a matter of faith, this is Dr. Alan Eichelman.
This has been As a Matter of Faith, produced in the studios of WUSM at the University of Southern Mississippi with the support of the College of Arts and Letters, the School of Mass Communication and Journalism, and the Department of Philosophy and Religion. Your host for As a Matter of Faith, Dr. Alan Eichelman. Producer, Jeff Rossier. Please share your comments and suggestions by emailing us at wusm@usm.edu.